Thank you, Alicia, for the introduction, and thank you everyone for coming to the talk. So today I'm going to talk about a simple model of quantum gravity based on these two papers. I will talk mainly about the first one. And I hope that I can learn more from you than the other way around. So please raise any question, comments, or criticism. So we know in classical GR, geometry is dynamical, but topology and dimension, at least classically, of space-time manifold is fixed. But in quantum gravity, if quantum fluctuations are very strong, it may be the case that topology and dimension may not be well defined. So we may want to consider a theory where not only geometry, but topology and dimension are also dynamical. And in the ADS-CFT correspondence, we learn that gravity can emerge as some collective degrees freedom of underlying quantum matter. There, some pattern of entanglement is captured as geometry. And given that, you know, underlying quantum matter can exhibit any pattern of entanglement, we may imagine that topology and dimension also arise as some collective degrees freedom of underlying quantum matter. So the goal of this talk is to consider a simple toy model of quantum gravity where geometry, topology, and dimension all emerge as collective degrees freedom of some well-defined quantum matter. This is not the first work on this direction. There are many prior works. I listed some of them, but I'm sure that there are many other works related to this direction. So first I will talk about the kinematic structure and of the theory, and then introduce the gauge symmetry, and then talk about the dynamics, okay? So this is the kinematic Hilbert space. So the fundamental degrees freedom is one matrix, N by L real matrix, okay? So I denote that matrix as phi. So capital A is a row index that runs from 1 to M. I is the column index running from 1 to L. But I'm going to call this row index as flavor and the column index as side, because I want to view this M by L matrix as a collection of L sides, and every side for every I, there are N scalar fields. Okay, that's one way to view this matrix. And as usual, we can label the basis state in terms of the eigenvalue of the matrix operator, okay? We use the usual inner product defined by this equation. Okay. So one thing just to emphasize is that although I call this column index I as site, so far there's no structure, there's no dimensionality. These sites will form some space manifold, but topology and dimension and geometry of the manifold will be determined by the quantum state of those matrix. Okay. So In order to define some notion of local site, we have to decompose the total kinematic Hilbert space as direct product of local Hilbert spaces. So HI is the local Hilbert space associated with site I. Okay, so at each site I, as I mentioned, there are M scalar fields, right? So there's a one column. They form a local Hilbert space. And then we can think about the local kinematic Hilbert space. But in general, there are different ways of partitioning the total Hilbert space into different local Hilbert spaces. For example, I can apply special linear L by L special linear transformation that rotate those sites into one another, okay, without changing this inner product, okay, and you can define some notion of local site in this rotated frame, okay, and one can equally well partition your total Hilbert space as direct product of local Hilbert spaces in this rotated frame. So that's called HI prime, okay? So in general, in this frame rotation, a local site in one frame corresponds to some linear superposition of multiple sites in another frame, okay? So the notion of local site depends on what frame you choose. But suppose we have chosen one frame, okay? And then now we can ask whether a state of this matrix has any notion of local structure or not. So roughly, this is just an intuitive picture. Roughly, we say a state has a local structure if the following conditions are satisfied. So the condition is the following. So first, there exists a mapping from each site into a Riemannian manifold with some well-defined dimension topology. And then second condition, which is more important, is that if I say choose any subset of the site and look at the von Neumann entanglement entropy between this subset with its complement, if this entanglement entropy is proportional to the proper volume of the boundary of the image of the subset A, okay, then we say there's a local structure. So it's a lot of work. So basically, the picture is that in the presence of mapping, I can view a quantum state of the matrix as a quantum state defined on some manifold, right? Maybe more accurately, defined on a lattice in the manifold. And if that quantum state is a short-range entangled in that manifold, if that quantum state obeys the area law, the boundary law of the entanglement, then we say there is a local structure. Okay, so this is rather formal. So let me give you some example. So suppose I consider the following simple state of the matrix. Again, this is the basis state, and this is the wave function. And the wave function is Gaussian, it's quadratic in phi, and it's labeled by this T is a L by L complex valued matrix. You can view it as label for different state. So in component form, trace T phi transpose phi is Tij phi I A phi J A, right? Okay. So, so this is the wave function. And this is a state labeled by T. So as you can see, if Tij as a L by L matrix, if it is diagonal matrix, then this state doesn't have any inter-side entanglement. It's just direct product state, right? Wave function is a direct product of local wave function. In the presence of inter-side bond, okay, so I call this Tij entanglement bond, because when Tij is non-zero between two sides, it creates non-trivial entanglement between those two sides, okay? So I can visualize a state in terms of those entanglement bonds. So here I draw a line between two sides if there is non-zero Tij between those sides. And one may quantify the strength of Tij in terms of the thickness of the bond, roughly speaking. And you can easily check that if you look at the mutual information, say between side I and J, this mutual information is proportional to the magnitude of this entanglement bonds in the limit that Tij is small. So it's not surprising when there's no off-diagonal elements, there's no entanglement.
A question?
Yes.
So here phi is the matrix.
Yeah.
So if T is diagonal, then it's in the exponential. Then if I expand the exponential, should I still have many coupling between different sites?
Not between different sites. Maybe there's a, between flavor, there's a, suppose, then is a e to the phi I phi I, right? And then for different I, it's a product of different wave function. So the total wave function is direct product of on-site wave function if Tij is diagonal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in this picture here, I say there's a one-dimensional local structure. As you can see, I have turned on this entanglement bonds to form a one-dimensional chain. And indeed, you know, if I choose any subset of the site and look at the entanglement entropy, it obeys the area law, a boundary law in 1D, in the 1D sense, right? So entanglement, say, between this site with the rest is mainly coming from these two bonds, okay? On the other hand, if I, for the same site, if I consider this kind of state, I say there are 2D local structure, because it's nothing but a squared lattice. But you know, this square lattice or chain is a property of state. These bonds are the property of those variable Tij. Some we can view this as some collective variable that label different states. For generic state, if you have Tij non-zero between any pairs of site, then you don't have a local structure at all, okay? So those states that have local structure are some special subset of state. Okay, they are special kind of state, but those are the ones that are interesting to us, because they are the one which can have extended space. Okay, so this is the kinematic Hilbert space. Now, to talk about dynamics, let's consider the gauge symmetry. So here I'm going to use the Hamiltonian formalism. So in GR, the gauge transformations are generated by the spatial diffeomorphism and the temporal one. So spatial diffeomorphism is generated by the momentum constraint P, and here Xi is a shift vector. Maybe I don't need to review this to this audience, but let me just point out that in GR, this spatial diffeomorphism does not change the dimension or topology, right? It acts in a manifold with a fixed dimension and topology. And we want to consider some things like a special diffeomorphism first. But given that the dimension and topology of the manifold is not fixed in the first place, and in principle, depending on which state we consider, you could have a special manifold in any dimension, any topology, right? As we have seen in the previous in this example, right? For example, if I turn on entanglement bonds between these two sides, in that state, the topology is a circle instead of open line, right? And then dimension can also change in different state. So therefore, the spatial diffeomorphism has to be enlarged to a group that includes diffeomorphism in any dimension, in any topology in general. So therefore, we want the gauge symmetry that corresponds to spatial diffeomorphism should be large enough to include diffeomorphism in any dimension. And we choose, therefore, this spatial linear frame rotation group to be our generalized spatial diffeomorphism, because this spatial linear transformation can rotate any site into any other site in the space of sites, right? Because any two points can be potentially very close to each other in certain state. There always exists certain state where any two points are spatially very close. So I should be able to generate some local translation that moves that point to that nearby points, right? So given that, I should be able to rotate any site into any other site. That's why I have chosen SLLR transformation as my generalized spatial diffeomorphism.
I have a question.
Just a quick question. Sorry, I'm a bit confused about, in your setting, there is no time and space yet, right?
Not yet, yeah. I just have a kinematic Hilbert space and I'm defining now gauge symmetry.
Right, okay, thanks.
So my question would be, so you have shown us, for instance, a state with S1 topology. If you apply, however, these gauge transformations, this S1 topology seems to change into something arbitrary, no?
That's right. So topology and dimension are not preserved under this spatial diffeomorphism. That's a very good point, yes.
Uh-huh. Wouldn't you like to preserve something under spatial diffeomorphism?
Since I want the dimension and topology to be dynamical in the first place, which topology my space is in is determined by the state, okay? So I guess physically you want to spontaneously break this full SLLR transformation into some smaller group that is more similar to the diffeomorphism in some fixed dimension. So once the gauge symmetry is broken into smaller group, then within that sector, the leftover unbroken gauge symmetry may preserve the topology and dimension. But at this higher level, it can change.
Okay, thanks.
There is also another question in the chat. Can we use S1 group in your model?
Sorry, which group?
S-U-N.
Oh, S-U-N. So first of all, this is a real matrix. Maybe in a complexified version, maybe you can do that. I think it's, it, it may, it, there may be SN, SUN version of theory like this, yeah. But in this theory that I'm considering a special linear group. And there's actually more constraint coming later. This is only the spatial deformation. Later, we want to combine this into Hamiltonian constraint, and I want them to form a closed algebra. And I don't know how to do it for other gauge group. So it may be possible, but I don't know how to do it. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. And there is also one more question by Hank.
Yeah. Hello, Sunsake.
Hi, Hank. Hi.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, because you mentioned something pretty interesting, which is that because the topology, dimension, geometry, they're all determined by the state.
Yeah.
That you define. So essentially, is it correct to understand that if I have T, the entanglement bond matrix, if I have a state determined by a T such that it, for example, commutes with a subgroup of SL of the frame rotations, then the local structure would have the sort of the structure that are determined. So for example, like if I preserve Z2, right? Z2 subgroup in SL, then I would have orientation.
Yeah, yeah. So I think this is related to Bianca's question. So
yes,
in some state, this T matrix may break some subgroup of SL, LR group, and then it may leave some subgroup intact. Okay, mm-hmm. Then maybe the unbroken gauge symmetry. Yeah. So it depends on state.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, that's very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So so this I just have written down the generator of this generalized spatial diffeomorphism. So again, phi is a matrix valued M by L matrix that I have originally, that's my fundamental degree of freedom. And pi is the conjugate momentum of phi, okay? It's a L by M matrix, okay? So basically pi times phi rotate side I to side j for all flavor index M is contractive, right? And then for SLL, our transformation, I need to have L by L traceless matrix, okay? So I need traceless because it's a special linear group. And this L by L matrix determines which direction I rotate this side, okay? So it's like a shift vector in GR. In shift, the shift vector determines the direction of local diffeo on the spatial slice. Likewise, this L by A matrix determines the direction of rotation in this space of site, okay? So I call this shift tensor as a generalization of shift vector. Okay, so let me just give you an example. Suppose I consider this state that has a one-dimensional local structure. Then in this case, it's natural to introduce a coordinate system, one-dimensional coordinate system, say Ri. So this is a mapping from each side to one-dimensional manifold. Maybe I can just choose Rj equals j, so that each side 1 to L is mapped to position 1 to L on a real line. Okay, that's one coordinate system I can choose. And then if I choose the shift tensor to be this kind of anti-symmetric tensor matrix that is non-zero between the nearest neighbor bonds, right? With some amplitude, the side dependent amplitude, then indeed under such transformation, my field operator, so matrix operator, is transformed in this way. So if the matrix if this matrix changes slowly in the one-dimensional space, okay, then one can do the gradient expansion, and to the leading order, one can easily check that this SLLR transformation generate the one-dimensional diffeomorphism. And of course, there are high order, more non-local transformation, because this SLR group is much bigger than the diffeomorphism. But here, the just point is that this is group that is big enough to include the diffeomorphism in one dimension here. And if the state has a two-dimensional local structure, this group includes the two-dimensional diffeomorphism group. Okay, so now let's move on to the Hamiltonian. So again, in GR, different time slices can be moved forward or backward using Hamiltonian. And because you can choose a different speed of evolution at different point in space, you can have a space-dependent lapse function here. And as we know, the key property is that the gauge symmetry generated by the momentum constraint and the Hamiltonian constraints form a closed algebra. In particular, the Poisson bracket between momentum and Hamiltonian is proportional to the Hamiltonian. It just means that the Hamiltonian density transforms as a scalar density under spatial diffeomorphism. I guess more non-trivial thing is the commutator or the Poisson bracket between the Hamiltonian and in GR, it is proportional to the momentum constraints. So in other words, if you evolve your Cauchy surface first with the lapse function one and then lapse function two, and then you evolve in a different order, then the difference between the final state can be compensated by diffeomorphism within the time slice, where the shift vector is given by gradient of those lapse function. More importantly, it is also proportional to the space metric here and signature of space and time. So that's why this algebra, the structure constant is not constant, it's a structure function because it depends on the dynamical variable, right? So this is going to be important for us in figuring out what actually is the emergent metric components, okay? So here, our goal is to construct some Hamiltonian constraint. First of all, that is closed under algebra with a momentum constraint, second of all, we want those algebra to reduce to this hypersurface deformation algebra of GR. Okay, so here's one choice. So the key condition that we want to satisfy is this thing where the commutator between, as a quantum operator, commutator between Hamiltonian is proportional to the generator of the generalized spatial diffeomorphism. And this is one operator that satisfies this constraint, okay? So again, the pi is a conjugate momentum of the matrix phi, right? So this is L by M matrix. And so pi transposes M by L. So this together is a L by L matrix. So to make a scalar, you have to trace with some symmetric tensor. And just as in GR, lapse function is a function of space. Here, this tensor, what I call lapse tensor, is in general a function of sight. Okay, so it's it is a L by L symmetric tensor. So it's very formal. So let me try to explain the meaning of this Hamiltonian in more detail. Okay, so first of all, this alpha tilde is just a pure number parameter of the theory, which is not fixed by any requirement from symmetry. And I have one over M squared to make the first and second term to be of the same order in the limit that M is very large. Okay, so it's instructive to dissect the Hamiltonian in the frame where this lapse tensor is diagonal. So it's a L by L symmetric matrix. So you can always go into the frame where this lapse tensor is diagonal. So let's look at the Hamiltonian in that frame. Okay, so then the SI represents a ith eigenvalue of the lapse tensor. And then in that frame, the first term is ultra local, pi i. This prime just means that I am writing the Hamiltonian in that rotated frame. But in that frame where lapse function, lapse tensor is diagonal, this is ultra local kinetic term. It's like P squared term, roughly speaking. And then here, I want you to focus on this term here, phi j phi k. So this is more like a gradient term or Hopping term. It creates a correlation between psi j and k, or it creates this matter hop from psi j and k, right? So usually in the usual local Hamiltonian, we consider there's a P squared term and then some Hopping term or gradient term in space, right? However, unlike usual Hamiltonian, here j and k are summed over all sides. Okay, so that means in principle, you can have a Hopping between any two sides in the system. So in that sense, this Hamiltonian look very non-local, okay? But the catch is that the Hopping amplitude between side J and K is not fixed, okay? It's not, we don't have underlying lattice structure to define the notion of nearest neighbor side. Here, instead, the amplitude of Hopping between side J and K is dynamically determined by other operator. Here, there are two bilinear operators. So here, pi I pi J times pi K pi I, okay? So here, you know, flavor index is contracted this way. So therefore, in the limit that flavor number is very large, this bilinear is almost classical in that its fluctuation is small. So I can, in the mean field sense, I can look at the expectation value of this bilinear operator in the large M limit. In this view, what we have is that the Hopping between psi J and K is determined by the expectation value of this operator. Okay, in particular, Hopping between psi j and k here, psi j and k is proportional to some kind of correlation that is present between psi I and j, the first bilinear, times correlation that is present between I and k, and I is all summed over, okay? And what is this correlation? Where, if you say, measure the expectation value of this operator with respect to that state that I was introduced before, this Gaussian state with labeled by this integument bonds matrix. Not surprisingly, there's a correlation between I and J if there's a non-zero integument bonds, right? So roughly speaking, this expectation value is proportional to Pij, so inverse of inverse. Roughly speaking, proportional to Tij. So it's some measure of entanglement between side I and j. Okay. So what this term says is that the hopping amplitude between site J and K is proportional to the entanglement that is present between site J and K through some third site I, okay? So if there's no entanglement between J and K, then this hopping term is very weak, okay? That physically means that if there's no entanglement between J and K, these two sites are physically very far from each other. So they don't talk to each other. So hopping is negligible. On the other hand, in a state where there's significant entanglement bond between site J and K, say through some site I, then we say these two sites are physically very close. Proper distance is very small so that there's a significant hopping, okay? So that's the idea. So this Hamiltonian is kinematically very non-local, right? Because you can have hopping between any pairs of sites. Nonetheless, it acts as a local Hamiltonian if you apply this Hamiltonian to a state which has a local structure. Okay, for example, if you apply this Hamiltonian to one of the states that I mentioned before, like the state that has a one-dimensional local structure, within that state, this Hamiltonian almost acts like a one-dimensional local Hamiltonian in the to the leading order in the large M ring. Okay, so Wei Cheng asked, is the ground state of this Hamiltonian the state T we start with? This is the generator of the gauge symmetry, okay? We are interested in physical state that is annihilated by this Hamiltonian. So that's the physical state that are of interest. Okay, it's not necessarily the state with the lowest energy, lowest eigenvalue of this operator. Okay. I guess short answer is no. The ground state of the Hamiltonian is not say this state of this Gaussian state. Okay. I have a generator of this G is the SLLR generator, the generalized spatial diffeomorphism, generalized momentum constraint, and H is a generalized Hamiltonian constraint. And the first thing to check is whether they form a closed algebra. And indeed they do. Actually, I have chosen the Hamiltonian so that they form a closed algebra. That was one of the guiding principles for choosing this Hamiltonian. Yes.
Perhaps including operator ordering issues.
Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Is it closed including operator ordering issues?
Yes, yeah. This is the exact expression as a quantum operator. So as we expect, of course, the commutator between SLLR generator is proportional to itself, right? With some structure constant. This is purely kinematic. And also commutator between SLLR and the Hamiltonian density, the Hamiltonian constraint as a matrix is proportional to the Hamiltonian matrix. It just means that this Hamiltonian matrix transforms as a rank 2 contravariant tensor under the spatial linear transformation. That's it. So these two lines is purely kinematic, and this A and B are just constant, structure constant. What is much more interesting and non-trivial is the commutator between two Hamiltonian constraints, and it is proportional to the generalized momentum and Hamiltonian, but in the large M limit, this part is subleading. So I'm going to focus on this part. And this is what we wanted, right? In GR, Poisson bracket between two Hamiltonian constraints is proportional to the momentum constraint. Likewise, here, this is the to the leading order in 1 over m. It is proportional to the generalized momentum. And this C, this, again, is not a structure constant. It's actually proportional to the dynamical variable. It is proportional to pi's and phi's. It's a rather complicated expression here. But these are, I forgot to put hat, but these are all operator. They are dynamical variable. So this is, they form a first class closed algebra as a quantum operator. Okay, so that seems promising. And then question is, can this algebra be reduced to the algebra that we know in GR in some limit? Okay. So, yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. So this quantum algebra reduces to the hypersurface deformation, some algebra that includes hypersurface deformation algebra of GR as a subalgebra, okay? If I identify the momentum constraint, okay, of GR in terms of the G, sorry, I use Cauley G, but this is same as this. The generator of SLLR transformation generator through this derivative, okay? So suppose I have a state with a local structure, some D-dimensional local structure, and I have chosen my coordinate system to reflect to make the locality manifest in this D-dimensional space, okay? Then, and if the field changes slowly in this D-dimensional manifold, and I can do I can define the derivatives and do the gradient expansion, okay? And then here I'm defining my momentum operator to be the first derivative of the generalized momentum constraint, okay? And the shift vector of GR is nothing but the first moment of the shift tensor here, okay? So here, if you want to know the shift vector at side I, okay, then you fix side I, and then sum over j multiplied with this distance between side I and j. So this is first moment of this shift tensor, okay? So if you identify shift vector and momentum density in this way, then the first line, this algebra implies this algebra, okay? Up to a higher derivative term, okay? To the first order in derivative, it is just the usual algebra that we expect for the momentum constraint. For the Hamiltonian, again, for us, the Hamiltonian is a L by L symmetric matrix. It's a matrix because, you know, you have a freedom to choose different frame, but once you have chosen a frame, and then if you choose the diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian, and if you choose that diagonal elements as your Hamiltonian density, and then similarly, you choose the diagonal elements of the Lefs tensor as your Lefs function, okay? Then these two algebra, commutator between G and H and H, goes back to the hypersurface deformation algebra of GR, okay? And then there's one more condition, provided that I identify the signature and the spatial metric in terms of the structure function C in this way. Okay, so let me just remind you. In GR, you know, the commutator between the Poisson bracket between Hamiltonian is proportional to the momentum constraint with the structure function that is dependent on signature of space-time and the spatial metric G mu nu, right? Likewise, for us, the Hamiltonian commutator between two Hamiltonian constraints is proportional to this structure function that depends on, it's a rank six tensor that depends on this dynamical variable, okay? So this must be related to the signature of space-time and the metric, right? That algebraically. So, and what I'm saying is that this algebra between the commutator between my Hamiltonian constraint reduces to the usual Poisson bracket of the GR if I identify the second moment of the structure function to be the metric times the signature of space-time. Okay? So to make the long story short, the bottom line is that I have this closed algebra of generalized spatial transformation, spatial diffeomorphism, and Hamiltonian constraints. But this algebra reduces to, in the continuum limit, reduces to an algebra that includes the hypersurface deformation algebra of GR if I identify metric in this way. Okay, so this is how I identify the emergent metric degrees freedom in terms of underlying matter degrees freedom. Okay, so remember this C, this rank six tensor is a product of this matrix phi and pi. It's some quantum operator that describes the matter degrees freedom.
I have a question because there is a diffeomorphism algebra on the right. You mentioned is a sub-algebra of the algebra on the left.
Yeah.
But I guess it's not really closed in itself because you have these corrections.
Yeah, there are higher derivative corrections. That's right. Yeah. I mean, to the leading order in the derivative expansion.
It's closed, but the higher order corrections are not closed.
That's right. Yeah, you're right.
They involve kind of things outside the sub-algebra.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Yeah. Right, so.
Maybe you can come back at the end and talk about which bill we should be concerned with that.
Yeah, I think this is an important point. I mean, yeah, it's only in the leading order in the derivative expansion. Okay, so I have kinematic Hilbert space, and I have the gauge symmetry, and then we can now consider some dynamics. So as usual, you know, physical states are supposed to be gauge singlets. It should be annihilated by G and H for any choice of Lefs function, Lefs tensor, and shift tensor. But in this example, it's pretty easy to show that all such gauge invariant states have infinite norm. It's not surprising, I guess, because gauge group is non-compact. So any wave function of gauge invariant states are extended in the space of in the configuration of space.
Yes, that's expected.
Yeah. And I know it's not surprising because gauge invariant states are supposed to capture a whole space-time history, not just a moment of time. So, you know, there's a same problem of how we define time in this theory as well. But at least we can try to extract some dynamic information by looking at the correlation between kinematic variables on the gauge orbit. So we can say consider some initial state, okay, some semi-classical initial state that satisfy the gauge constraint at the semi-classical level. And then we can solve the Cauchy problem. We evolve this state by evolving this state with the Hamiltonian, right? And then we look at what kind of correlations are generated along the orbit. So this is what we can do. So we start some semi-classical state that satisfy the gauge constraint only to the leading order in large n, but not precisely. And then you evolve that semi-classical state using this Hamiltonian and see what kind of correlations are present among some, I guess, partial observables of the system. So here's one example. So here I have
You seem to have only one Hamiltonian and one momentum constraint. It's kind of confusing.
Yeah, so Hamiltonian and momentum are all L by L matrix. Okay, so, and this this side index, basically HII, this diagonal elements of this Hamiltonian plays a role of Hamiltonian density at different sites.
Ah, okay. So there is indeed just one Hamiltonian in this sense. Okay.
Yeah, one matrix.
One big matrix. Okay. Yeah, okay. Thanks.
So here these are the matrix, the lapse tensor and this shift tensor. Okay. Yeah.
But wouldn't then you need to integrate over all choices of lapse?
Yeah, that's right. So for the fully gauge invariant state, you have to integrate over all choices of lapse and shift. That's right. But so there are many different directions of time. I don't know. Different ways.
Many finger time.
Yeah, many fingers. Yeah, there are many fingers, right? So you can evolve your state in a different fingers, okay? Depending on how you choose your lapse function, lapse tensor, okay? So here I don't have time for that, but that's the actual story of the second paper, which is that now the space-time that you see depends on which finger you choose, and which finger you choose depends on how you choose your clocks, right? So you choose your clocks, set up local clocks in one frame, and then you can look at the finger where this local clocks remains unentangled, okay? And then in that time evolution, you see one space-time manifold. Okay, but you could choose different set of clocks where now new clocks are non-local from the perspective of the first choice of clocks. But in this theory, we have freedom to choose different clocks. So the second set of clocks can be very non-local with respect to the first set of clocks, but you can choose those clocks as your local clocks. And then you can look at the finger of the time where this new set of clocks remain unentangled, okay? And then in that time evolution, you see completely different space-time manifold, okay? So I call this clock-dependent space-time. But here, let me just consider a very simple example where I choose my initial state to be a state that has a three-dimensional local structure, okay? And here this picture is supposed to represent the bounds of Tij that is non-zero. There are like millions of sites, and I turn on my Tij to be non-zero on this waste so that it has a three-dimensional local structure. And then, as I said, in the limit that matrix size is very large, these collective variables become semi-classical. So then I can solve this Cauchy problem along one finger of time evolution semi-classically. And then I can ask what kind of space-time I can obtain. Because this is one exercise we can do. And here is a actual solution. Here, I have chosen the three-dimensional space-time that is that has the discrete rotation symmetry and translational symmetry, etc. So that spatial manifold is just parameterized by a scale factor A, and it's isotropic, okay? And then here, I'm plotting the scale factor A as a function of the parameter time. I mean, this is not real time. I'm just following how the size of the universe changes along the gauge orbit. And then I'm also plotting the signature of time, because as I mentioned here, both signature and space manifold metric are determined by this dynamical variable here in this theory, okay? So I have chosen the spatial metric to have a positive signature. And with respect to that, signature of time can change. And this is what you get. So say initially, so there's some periodic, it's not perfectly periodic, but there is some a repetition of say this segment is this iter space where signature is negative here. And the size of the space starts at infinity and then reaches a minimum and then explode to infinity again. And then at this parameter time, there's some dynamical phase transition where the signature of space-time change from Lorentzian to Euclidean. So here now is a Euclidean space and time. And again, the size of the slice start from infinity and then shrink and then go to infinity and going through another set of phase transition. So you have some series of Disiter-like space-time with Lorentzian signature. And in between, there's some Euclidean four-dimensional space bridging those Lorentzian space-time. And I find interesting what happens at this phase transition. This is what happens. So here I'm plotting the entanglement bond in momentum space, right? So Tij is the entanglement bond between site I and J. And then in the presence of translational invariance is function of only I minus J, the distance, right? Relative distance. Then it's convenient to look at the Fourier transformation of it, right? So this is what I call T, entanglement bond in the momentum space, T of K. And then basically if T of K was flat, if it didn't have the momentum dependence, that means Tij is ultra local, right? Because if Tij is a delta function in I minus J, then T of K will be featureless in the momentum space. So flat Tk means that no entanglements, and no entanglement means that any two points have a very long distance physically, right? Whereas if T of K has a big curvature here, it has a strong K dependence. That means Tij is more long-ranged in the real space, right? So that means physical size is small because there's a long-range entanglement. So two sites that are far from each other in coordinate. They are actually close to each other, right? So the curvature of this entanglement variable T, K, captures the roughly the size of the universe, okay? So, you know, when the curvature is big, that's when the size of the universe is small, say here, right? And then as parameter time evolves, the curvature becomes smaller and smaller. And what happens is that at this critical point, the it becomes locally flat. Okay, it doesn't become completely flat. It's not flat band, but the second derivative of TK vanishes, okay? That's when the size of the universe diverge. And then on the other side of the evolution here, on the right-hand side, now the curvature changes sign, okay? So this curvature, whether it's positive or negative, now determines the signature of time in this theory, okay? And this phase transition between Lorentzian space-time to Euclidean space-time happens when the curvature of the entanglement spectrum become locally flat. Okay, so this is some we call Lipschitz transition. And the one minor point is that, you know, at the critical point, there's no well-defined geometry, essentially, because everything is infinitely far from each other. Nonetheless, the entanglement spectrum is not completely flat here, meaning that there are still non-trivial entanglements, okay? Although it's not captured by geometry, you still have non-trivial classical entanglement. So I'm just raising this point because entanglement is much more than just geometry. Okay, some people say entanglement is geometry, but this is one counterexample where entanglement is much more than geometry. Some part of the entanglement is captured geometrically, but there are non-geometric entanglements, right? For example, even though at this critical time it's locally flat, there are high order moments in real space, and that is not captured by geometry. Geometry, basically the G mu nu, the metric tensor is determined by second moment of the entanglement bonds. But even if second moments are zero, there are higher moments that keep some non-trivial entanglements. Okay, so now once you have this saddle point solution, then you can in principle consider small fluctuations around the saddle point. And in this theory, the small fluctuations are bilocal. Okay, so fluctuations of this collective variable Tij, and these bilocal excitations basically propagate in the space-time set by this saddle point equations motion. Okay, so so this is the last slide. So let me just mention some open questions. So as Bianca pointed out, this is not GR yet because the gauge symmetry is pretty big. So in order to have GR to emerge as an effective theory, you have to consider some special states where this higher order gauge symmetry is broken down to, say, diffeomorphism in certain dimension. Then within this sector, you may have a general relativity as an effective theory, but we are not there yet. And also, we don't know what the physical spectrum of this theory is. Yeah, so, okay. Yeah, so that's it. Thank you. Thank you for your attention. Sorry for running over time.
Thanks, Hans, for the nice talk. Okay, are there questions?
I can ask one technical question, one general question. The technical question is, do I remember right that when you were constructing the Hamiltonian constraint, you had the pi squared analogous term and the derivative term. And you said you add them together with a parameter which is arbitrary. Is that true the whole way through?
This parameter alpha?
Yes. Is that arbitrary?
Yeah, I mean, there's some bound for this parameter in order for the space of states that satisfy the gauge constraint to be non-trivial. But other than that, it's not fixed by, there's no unique value that can be fixed. So it's a free parameter in this theory.
Okay, thank you. And the second question is, what Dirac wanted us to do, what nobody has ever been able to do, is when you have the physical states that are in the kernel of the constraint, you said correctly that they have infinite norm, but can you find another norm, which is a norm just on the kernel in which they're finite?
You mean, yeah, so here when I say infinite norm, I'm using the norm of the underlying quantum Merrill degrees freedom.
So right, but that's not gauge invariant. So we agree, we would say that's not the physical norm. Physical norm should be just on the physical states, it's just on the kernel. And you can pick it additionally, just so that it makes the physical states in the kernel normalizable.
And basically you look at some kind of flux, is that what you have in mind?
No, that's not the only thing. Well, we were never able, I'm not aware that anybody was able in a strict Hamiltonian approach to solve that problem.
Uh-huh, I see. Okay.
But the thing is, you can avoid it because you think of the path integral as a projector on the constraint. And then you can kind of consider the kinematical inner product with the path integral inserted. And that defines you the physical inner product in some sense.
Yes.
So it's a bit in the direction you have written, just that you only ever age in some sense with respect to one particular choice of labs, which certainly is not sufficient. You know, that would be in principle acting as a projector onto your given state. And if you can kind of get from that the physical inner product. I wanted to comment that there has been some work which might be related to yours. I just try to remember the author. I don't think Lee remembers. It's a Japanese person who worked on tensor models. If I remember, I will let you know.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I don't remember this, but. So I think this is pretty impressive. Even if it fails in the end, it's certainly an approach that goes a long way to doing something like what we'd want.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe so, I have a question.
Sorry, Bianca, okay. There was a hand who had the raised hand since a while, so I would give the word to Hank first.
Thank you. So, thank you again for the very nice talk.
I have a question.
Please, Hank first, and then Young, and then Bianca.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask, like, because here you start out with a whole bunch of sites, and then, you know, you assign local structure associated to these sites, so they're, like, I guess, by definition, local, right? So they sort of probe the local frame, and the Riemannian manifold. So I'm just wondering, because like, if I were to, for example, I want to model a quantum system, and I want to construct, for example, maybe there's a framing anomaly, like a topological order with framing anomaly. And I know that's, for example, Z2 or Yeah, like the anomaly set too, and then I would construct a lattice model, which like basically it's the same construction as your kinematical states, right? I can just write down a lattice model with a Hilbert space attached at each point, and we have SL representations for these Hilbert spaces on each site. But I think these are just what is it, codimension one, right? These are essentially charges attached to the sites. I'm just wondering, like, have you thought about having intrinsically non-local objects in this in your theory, right? Because for example, if you have maps from sites to the Riemannian surface, you probe like the local structure. You probe, for example, the metric at each point. You probe, stuff at each point. but if you have, because like in 3D, I know that, and I think you also know that there are fractons. Fractons have, fractal models have like point-like and string-like excitations as well, right? Yeah, so. I'm just wondering, maybe that's also a direction that we can go in, which sort of refines the this approach, essentially. I don't know what we will get. Maybe that's not the right direction, but yeah.
Yeah, I guess in this theory, and I think indeed in all theories that I know of for dynamical gravity, there are the kinematically those theories include some non-local degrees freedom. This is not an exception in that, you know, here the dynamical variables are emergent dynamical degrees freedoms are this kind of collective variables that parameterize entanglement that is present between different sites. And these are not local variables, right? They are, it's like a, it's bi-local. It lives in the space of two points.
Right, right.
So it's like it's not string theory. But I think if you do some exercise like this for general tensor model instead of matrix model, then you may have something like stringy excitation. But in any case, I think. The kinematic degrees freedoms are not local in this theory.
Right. These are kind of the holonomies, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. You can view it. You can view it that way. So.
Mm. I see. Yeah. Because holonomies and fluxes as well, right? And there's a way to sort of use two group structures to encode. Like two holonomies on surfaces using a two-group structure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might, I don't know, that might be important for quantum gravity, but so far, I don't think, there's a consensus. But yeah, thank you.
I have a question about the constrained algebra.
Mm-hmm.
So, and focus on the Hamiltonian commutator. Okay, the third one on the left. Mm-hmm. So the first term have a product of operators, mm-hmm. but the GMN, the Gaussian constraint, is all at the end, right? Right end of the first term. So my question here is, generally, there could be a ordering problems to obtain a form like this, right?
Yeah. So here everything is discrete, right? So it's a discrete matrix, and you can compute this. You can compute this commutator explicitly including the fact that these operators do not commute. So this C and G do not commute in general, as you mentioned, right?
Right, yeah. So this must depend on the special form you have taken for your Hamiltonian, right?
Yes, yeah, it depends. This algebra is true for the Hamiltonian that I introduced earlier. And
yeah,
indeed, the way I constructed the Hamiltonian is guided by the requirement that this form of.
Right, yeah. So I think this actually is a very important point that, namely, there exists such a Hamiltonian that, this the commutator has this particular form, namely separation of some C's of G's, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
This actually is important.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so that this is, how about the second term? Second term is also true, actually is only approximate.
It is true. This is exact expression, and you can.
Okay. So both two terms are exact.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, very good. Yeah. So, yeah.
Thank you
very much. Yeah. In a certain sense, you are fortunate, to be able to construct such, Hamiltonian HSIJ, so that the commutator has certain. I may say simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, normally it could be a big mess.
That's
right.
The
right hand. Okay, thank you.
That's right, yeah. Thank you, yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for this nice talk.
Thank you.
In your construction, you have quite this, you do in some sense consider really space. Yeah, it's not very clear to me, but there seems to be quite a difference between space and time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would get only your results in some sense after solving for everything. But say, do you have any idea how to ensure something that you do get something like a local version of Lorentz invariance or something?
You mean local Lorentz invariance, like for spinning?
Yeah.
Mm. So here, everything is bosonic here. But I guess in principle, you can have fermionic extension. Then you may have
I guess it's going already in a different direction, but. Do you think of your entanglement structure as, I guess, entanglement in space, no?
Yes, entanglement in space.
But which you then kind of evolve.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Actually, I didn't mention in this talk, but this is one point that I'm also confused about, is that, this some state defined on this site actually already can have some time-like direction already.
Mm-hmm.
So in this particular example, I have chosen my initial state Tij such that they all have the same signature in this three-dimensional direction.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not necessary. You can have a state where already there's a different signature in different direction. In this seemingly space-like manifold, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So then maybe it's more useful to have a description that is more space-time-like. I mean, here I'm using a Hamiltonian description where I choose the formulate everything in this slice, but if I have a space-time-like description that may be more illuminating. But I don't know how to, there may be a way to do it, but I don't know at the moment.
Okay, but you mentioned that well, in the second paper, you considered the time evolution in some sense with respect to different lapses or different clocks.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And that, I think, relates to the question of Lorentz invariance. And mm-hmm. You see very different results if you choose different directions of evolution.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. If you choose a different set of site as your local site,
mm-hmm.
then space-time perceived by those local observers are very different from the space-time perceived by different local observers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, so it kind of makes me wonder, you know, what's special about the local site we have here, right? So what if we create a clock that is highly entangled, constructed out of some highly entangled qubit of here and somewhere in the Andromeda, right? And then I can claim this qubit is local qubit, okay? Mm-hmm. And I can try to construct local notion of local site made of those qubits. And of mm-hmm. course, from their perspective, our space-time may look completely non-local, right? But in principle, I think in this theory, they are kind of treated equal footing so that it has the freedom to change frame such that in different frames, space-time look drastically different. Yeah, maybe it's too drastic. I think that's possible.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, one very last question by Tom.
I have a question. Can I ask a question? Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Sansik, for a very nice talk.
Hi, Tom.
I have a question about just your main, this equation, this wave function.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true that this is, I was trying to understand, do these wave functions always have some non-trivial sign structure, or are they wave functions of similar kind, which may have maybe positive sign and can be even simulated in a computer? They always, you have a very, right now they are complex numbers and.
Yeah, they are in general complex matrix. So
but if I somehow impose a condition that there's some, some kind of positiveness or some kind, let's say, so that you can simulate on a computer.
Yeah.
Without sign problem, do you think you lose all the physics?
I'm not sure. So we're in the large M limit, when the flavor number is large, this complex matrix become classical anyway. The quantum mm-hmm. flavor of Kij is small.
Mm-hmm.
So in the this result that I showed here is when this Tij is purely
real, I guess.
Clear, yeah. But mm-hmm. if you can imagine a state where it is complex, and then you may have more, but you don't lose this classicality. You may mm-hmm. have some, I think mm-hmm. you end up introducing some kind of some gauge flux in principle. But,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I ask one more question? Actually, just what is the relation of this approach, if any, to more, older approaches of using matrices to describe emergent space-time, or there's no relation at all?
To which one?
I'm thinking the kind of stuff people like Sean Hartnell's work, or I know you have this, I don't fully understand, but the idea is that the somehow use the eigenspectrum of matrices to describe some emergent, I don't know. I don't think I can formulate it in a way which is maybe But people do talk about using, I don't know, how to put it, that the I don't know, the emergent direction is something to do with the I don't know, with this eigen spectrum, this matrices in some way. Okay, I don't know. I think I have nothing to say. But I'm just wondering, is there any relation to any previous approaches to emergent space-time in, I don't know, in string theory or more?
I guess the best understood example is ADS-CFT, right? In that
right. Way. So the question I had was, what's the, do you have those features? I mean, I was not sure what's the relation. For example, is it a Ryu-Takenagi formula for the?
I think there are some relations. So the relation is that, this initial state that I was considering here in ADS-CFT is played by the boundary field theory.
Mm-hmm.
And this evolution that generate the gauge orbit in this example is kind of evolution that evolved the boundary toward the bulk in ADS-CFT. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's some kind of, people usually think of it as some kind of coarse graining operator, because in ADS-CFT, the radial direction is some kind of arch direction. But formally speaking, you have some quantum operator that generate the evolution toward the bulk. And that is essentially some kind of, gauge constraint. Okay. In from the point of view of quantum gravity, of course, in ADS-CFT, the boundary state, I guess that's also similar. In the boundary state, is not annihilated by, it's not physical in the sense that they are not annihilated by the gauge constraint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why you have a non-trivial evolution as you go into the bulk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it's similar. I guess the biggest difference is the signature is in the ADS-CFT, the boundary theory already has a space and time.
Right.
And then the bulk evolution is kind of space-like. But mm-hmm. here is the example that I showed is that boundary theory is kind of Euclidean, and then the radial evolution is time-like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the difference, but I think at the higher level there is.
But more standard like results, like are you talking Ryu-Takenagi formula or even, I don't know, any of those things? Do they have some analog here? Or do you have similar?
I think so. I think there will be, you can ask those questions in this context as well. What is the entanglement between two subset of sight, and how can you understand from the kind of bulk perspective?
And this signature changing phase transitions, are they, I mean, Lipschitz theories are often, at least, I didn't quite follow what kind of Lipschitz theory had, but often Lipschitz theories are very, can be weakly coupled because your dynamical exponent is larger or something, but are they strongly coupled in your case? What do you understand about the critical point in terms of?
Yeah, here is a semi-classical. So I'm considering large M limit. So it's weakly coupled everywhere throughout the evolution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of this entanglement bond parameter, entanglement bonds, and going through the Lipschitz transition as a function of parameter time. The evolution itself is a semi-classical in the large M limit. I guess your question is more about if you consider some small fluctuations around this setting point, maybe the quantum theory of those small fluctuations, whether those quantum theory become more weakly coupled near this Lipschitz point. Yeah, I think that is possible because it will have
Okay. I don't know. I mean, I can ask them just maybe a very obvious question. In
Sorry, so I would say, since we are essentially running out of time, that we close the discussion now, and perhaps you can continue discussing via email.
Sounds good, thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Also, notice that Bianca shared an article, probably that was the paper she was talking about. So perhaps you can open that before closing the Zoom, because otherwise you would lose the reference. But say so. I would ask everyone to unmute themselves to thank Samsik for the very nice talk and the discussion.
Thank you, Bianca, for the reference.